Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. A quick reminder that you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, any of the places where you can find good podcasts or even not so good podcasts. But there are a lot of podcasts out there. And I'm really conscious of the fact that we're in competition with every single one of them. And I don't know, maybe somebody's done a study of how many podcasts people can listen to. I'm thinking it's probably around five or six, but that would be maximum. And so, you know, I understand that we ask a lot of our subscribers because we do this every single day. There are a lot of podcasts, but very few of them, with the exception of, say, Michael Barbaro at the New York Times, do it every single day. But again, we're very, very grateful to all of our guests and all of our listeners, and we think it's going to be extraordinarily interesting over the next several months to follow everything that's going on, and we're going to do the best that we can to be as current as we can. We try to do the deep dive, but we also try to be as relevant as possible, and we're going to try that again today. We have a very special guest, Kyle Kondik, who is the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. Thanks for coming in and talking to us, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
Well, this is you have a piece. Your blog is called 720 to Win, right? Is that I'm just looking at the printout here. 720 to Win. I'm sorry. 270 to Win. I'm sorry.
No, that's 270 to Win is actually a site we're friends with, and at 270 to Win, you can make your own electoral maps, and so that's not our site, but we like them a lot.
Okay, well, the point is that though I constantly have to remind people that the public opinion polls nationally are not going to predict necessarily who wins. And I understand that people don't like the Electoral College, but that is the game, you know. In football, it's a touchdown is 7 points whether you like it or not. So it's just, and it's going to take 270 to win. I must suffer from dyslexia or something like that. Not to mean to be offensive that I read that as 720 to win. I don't know what that was. I think I stayed up too late.
It just feels that way for the Democrats.
I think I stayed up too late celebrating the Brewers making the playoffs in any case.
Congratulations.
So I wonder, hey, thank you. It was an awesome season, especially the end. I mean,
We Cleveland Indians fans are on pins and needles, and they did not have a particularly good night last night, so we shall see.
All right, so let's talk about your piece, the expanding the map of the Electoral College, that you point out that Trump is at least a small underdog in all of the Clinton states, but he's trying to play offense. And this is the interesting twist of this, is that Donald Trump is trying to expand the electoral map. So does he honestly think that he can, and you're focusing on the fact that he's going after New Mexico, right? That he's actually trying to flip a state that he lost by 8 points, right?
Yeah, and that was sort of the news hook for the story, because you may recall within the last couple of weeks that Trump was in New Mexico, and Trump's team has been sort of bullish about it. I personally don't see it, at least in that state. Trump lost the state by 8. So that was a pretty decent performance for Hillary Clinton. Granted, Barack Obama did better in the state, but New Mexico used to be a pretty good electoral bellwether, maybe even had a little bit of a Republican lean, but that's one of the states that in recent years I think has definitely trended into the Democratic column, and certainly nothing from the midterm results would suggest of a Republican trend. The Democrats won all the congressional districts in the state, including New Mexico 2, which is actually a Republican-leaning seat, and the Democrats swept the statewide offices. So in terms of the specifics of New Mexico, I don't really see it for Trump. But almost every reelected president, with one major exception, Barack Obama in 2012, which is the most recent example, if a president gets reelected, they typically do win at least one or more states that they didn't carry the first time that they were elected. Sometimes a reelected president will carry many more states they didn't carry, so like, you know, Nixon 1972 and Reagan 1980 are two great examples. Not that you'd ever expect, even if Trump wins again, to win in some sort of big landslide, but you might expect that Trump might be able to flip one or more states that he lost last time. And I would look specifically at New Hampshire, that was super close last time, maybe Minnesota, because the trend line for Republicans in that state is actually pretty decent, although Hillary Clinton still carried it. And There also is usually there tends to be kind of a higher third party vote in Minnesota that I think might maybe obscure the Democratic advantage in that state. Or, you know, Nevada is also a state that is usually very, very competitive. So, again, I don't really buy it on New Mexico for the Republicans, but I do see the impetus to try to make the Democrats play defense in some of these places, particularly because the president's going to have more resources than he's had in the past. Now, granted, you know, I'm operating on the assumption that he will be the Republican nominee that'll be running for reelection. Maybe there are things like impeachment that might interrupt that. But if you're just assuming that he's going to be the nominee, he should be better funded than last time and maybe can run a more robust operation.
I just don't get the New Mexico thing, though, because the 2018 Democrats swept all the statewide races, all the federal and statewide races. And it's got a really large percentage of Hispanic voters. In fact, it's got the largest percentage of Hispanic voters of any state, which would not seem to be promising for Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, again, you know, are there a number of Hispanics who voted for Trump? Yes. But that's still definitely a Democratic leaning constituency. And, you know, some of the things that the Trump people bring up, they say, oh, well, you know, we had a big rally there and there were all these people who registered. I mean, even though I think that the Trump rallies in some way were an indication of strength in 2016, you know, I don't necessarily know if you should base big sweeping conclusions based on people going to rallies. I mean, you know, the great famous example was, you know, in the waning days of the 1972 election, all these reporters saw these huge crowds for George McGovern and they thought, oh my God, could this guy be pulling a big upset? And then, you know, he lost by a gigantic landslide. So again, you know, I don't quite get it on New Mexico, but I get the overall theme. You know, if you're in the president's position and his election was very tenuous in 2016, you got to be trying to expand the map, I think, in some ways. And again, I think there are options for him, just maybe not New Mexico. That feels a little bit more like kind of a feint to me.
Okay, so I'm looking at your overall. This is the Sabato crystal ball, your electoral college. Let's take the snapshot at the moment. You basically, because you want to mess with us, right? You have this as a dead tie,
right?
The Democrats either safe, likely, or lean 248 electoral votes. Republicans lean, likely, safe 248. Just a dead heat with just 42 electoral votes rated as toss-ups, and the only electoral votes you have rated as toss-ups: Pennsylvania 20. Wisconsin 10, Arizona 11, and Nebraska, second congressional district?
That's right.
Yeah, it's weird that they do it that way. But anyway, so that's 42 electoral votes. So,
and I tell you what, it could be so close that those single electoral votes, there's the one in Omaha, which is Nebraska 2, and then also there is the upper two-thirds of Maine, roughly, which Trump actually carried, Maine's second congressional district, in the 2016 election. And one little wild card there is it looks like Maine may very well have ranked choice voting for president, which actually allowed the Democrats to win a House seat last time, even though in the first round of voting, the Republican actually got more votes. So that's something to watch, too. And, you know, there are scenarios in which you could look at a 269-269 tie, or a scenario where maybe that single electoral vote from Maine or Nebraska could be decisive. Now, you know, it may be that some of these national polls are correct and, you know, Joe Biden is leading Trump by a lot. But as you noted earlier, I don't necessarily see that in the state data. I mean, I don't think Trump is doing particularly well, but he's within striking distance in, I think, the states that matter.
Well, let's look at this. The states that you have as leaning Democratic, this would be Virginia, Maine, Colorado, Nevada, Minnesota, and Michigan.
Yeah, and the one I think that would throw some people off on that is Michigan, given that the president carried it last time. Although I think that was basically the flukiest of the president's wins. You can really look at pretty poor turnout for Democrats in the greater Detroit area that I think a better organized campaign and a better candidate could correct. I think the problems in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania for Democrats are a little bit harder to fix, even though those states were very, very close last time, too. So again, I think the Democrats should probably feel the best about Michigan of the Trump won states. But even then, that's sort of precarious.
Yeah. And I'm looking at the states that you have as leaning Republican: Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Iowa, Ohio, and Texas. The only ones there that look like that I would think that would be really juicy prospects for Democrats would be North Carolina and Iowa. But then again, tell me about Florida and where you think that's trending.
I just mentioned a little bit ago that Minnesota may be sort of deceptively competitive because the third party vote may sort of maybe hurt the Democrats a little bit more than the Republicans. Maybe it's the opposite in Florida, in that Democrats often come very close to winning that state. And of course, it's super competitive. And yet the Democrats just keep losing. I mean, Obama did carry it twice, but in a number of other very close statewide elections, including in 2018, you know, the Democrats came up short. And I've made this point many times before, but I know why it happened. Specifically, I think there were resource disadvantages the Democrats had, and I don't know if their candidates ended up working out all that well. But the Democrats should not have lost the governor's race in Florida in 2018, and they should not have lost Bill Nelson's Senate seat. That just shouldn't have happened in a year like 2018 when the wind was otherwise at their backs. I mean, I think it makes a lot of sense that the Democrats lost Senate races in Indiana, Missouri, and North Dakota, which are all states that are considerably right of center now, and in a time of sort of partisan polarization, harder to get more crossover votes, and also sort of a nationalization of elections, it makes sense that Democrats would lose Senate seats even in a Democratic year in those states. But Florida did just, I think, is indefensible that happened, and I think it calls into question whether the Democrats can win that state in 2020. Now, granted, if the president is losing by 6-7 points nationally, then of course you'd expect Florida to vote Democratic. But if the race is again close, if it's akin to 2016, I think Florida is a state that you'd expect to be right of center and to be voting more Republican. I mean, this electoral map that we have is sort of predicated on another close general election. Maybe the Democrat is winning the national popular vote again, and potentially by more than last time. And yet a lot of these states, I think, still seem close. And of course, there's a whole lot we don't know: identity of the Democratic candidate, state of the economy, and whether perceptions of the president are going to change all that much. Certainly recent news about Ukraine and whatnot, these are explosive stories. But I also haven't seen that things like the Mueller report and other serious questions about the president's various improprieties. To me, they haven't really moved the numbers all that much.
Yeah,
granted,
they might.
Go ahead.
No, I want to come back to that. Because I want to talk to you about how you think the impeachment is going to play out, because that is going to be happening. But on this issue of Florida, and my reaction was the same in 2018, and certainly the polls suggested the Democrats were going to have a good night, and they didn't. So how is Florida's electorate changing?
So Florida continues to be a very fast growing state. It's going to add at least a couple more House members after the 2020 census. And, the growth there has been explosive. And I think that a lot of us sort of fell into this trap a few years ago in thinking, oh, well, Florida is becoming more diverse. There's growth in particularly Hispanics, and therefore that's good for Democrats. But you got to remember that for all of the growth in demographics favorable to Democrats in that state, there's also a lot of growth in demographics favorable to Republicans, namely that there's this unending stream of retirees from all over the country, but a lot of places in the Midwest in particular, of kind of white conservative voters from the Midwest moving to Florida. And so you can really see it in the results, in that these places that are heavy with these retirees, like where, for instance, like the Villages is, that huge retirement complex. The Democrats are struggling in those places. And so while the Democrats get demographic reinforcements in that state, the Republicans do too. And it's this continuing kind of arms race and growth. And to me, it's the upshot is that Florida isn't really, it's not really trending one way or the other, or it may even be getting a little bit more Republican relative to the nation because the growth there is actually on net either neutral or beneficial to Republicans.
Well, and also many of those people that are moving moving there because of obviously the weather, but
sure.
also because they have no state income tax. And
right.
you know, I remember when I first heard that the Democrats were basically running in 2018 saying that they were going to create a state income tax. I'm thinking, you know, does anyone actually think that that is a winning strategy given the kinds of people that are now moving into Florida and why they're moving into Florida?
It's interesting, too. Steve Shale, who's a Florida Democratic consultant and really knows the state incredibly well. I remember talking to him after the election and in 2016, and he was telling me that you could sort of look at the places where there are a lot of Midwestern expats, basically, and sort of compare those places to maybe the places that they're from in the Midwest, and you sort of see similar patterns in terms of support for Trump. And it's just kind of an interesting state, one that obviously remains at the center of American politics and is electorally super important. But again, it's just I think there was this mistaken thought that it was trending Democratic, and I really don't think that.
Well, there's a lot of course, buzz, and some of it sounds, at least to me, very much wishful thinking about Texas. The Texas is going to turn blue, and maybe eventually it will. But you have it down here as a leaning Republican. And again, in 2018, you had Beto O'Rourke, who was certainly not underfunded in any way whatsoever, running against one of the most unpopular Republicans in the country, Ted Cruz, in a big Democratic year. And he did do a lot better than anybody expected, but he did fall short. On the other hand, I'm reading lots and lots and lots of stories about the exploding suburbs and urban areas, that the kinds of, the population growth in Texas, in fact, is trending the opposite way you're describing Florida, that it looks like the people who are moving into Texas might tend to be more Democratic, or is that incorrect?
I think that that's true. And, you know, again, there's a minority population component to that, but there's also these big suburban/exurban counties that used to be just blood red and now are trending more Democratic. And I think one place to watch, not necessarily that it's going to definitively tell the tale of the state, is Tarrant County, which is where Fort Worth is. That remains one of the few highly populated counties in the whole country that actually still votes Republican for president. But it actually voted very narrowly for O'Rourke in the Senate race. And if Tarrant County turns into sort of a swing county or maybe even a Democratic-leaning county in the next 4 to 8 years, plus you have explosive Democratic growth in the big cities and also in these suburban areas, in a state that is obviously still experiencing explosive growth. Texas is going to add, I think, at least 3 new members of the House after the new census. That's when the state really starts to get competitive. I guess I'd be surprised if the Democrats carried it in 2020, but I'd say 2024, 2028, if current trends continue, you might see that. Although we also have to remember this, that like if the Democrats win the White House in 2020, and let's say they win the Senate and they win the House too, and so they have a trifecta of power in Washington, and let's say that they actually do try to pass some of their very aggressive policy programs, it's very easy to imagine that many of those suburban areas that swung to the Democrats in the time of Trump would swing back to the Republicans in 2022, and then the trends that we're seeing now may either be stunted or actually reverse themselves. So it's hard to think of this as being a straight line, because as much as we think about voters as being inflexible, and many of them are, there are a lot of people who change their mind from election to election. With a new president in the White House, that calculus could just totally change. So I'd say the long-term growth in Texas may very well be favorable to Democrats, but we also can't assume that is going to become a true swing state.
Okay, let's talk about the true toss-up states, because there are only 3 of them on your map right now: Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Arizona. Tell me about Pennsylvania. That was one of the biggest surprises on election night. Republicans had always been talking about we can win Pennsylvania. They never do. So when they flip Pennsylvania, that was, that's That was the tale of the tape in 2016. So are you basing this on reputable polls now? What are you seeing?
I don't know if we're really based on polls at this point. I think we're sort of looking at you know the 2016 trends and so just sort of our general sense as to where things are. But I think that you know what we saw in Pennsylvania is very similar to what we saw across many other states that you would consider either part of the Midwest or you know Pennsylvania is not technically in the Midwest, but the old so-called blue wall in the Rust Belt. And what you saw was that, you know, Hillary Clinton did really well in Allegheny County, where Pittsburgh is. I think she did fine, not as well as Obama did in Philadelphia, but she made up for that a little bit in the Philadelphia suburbs. But then the rest of the state mostly got very, you know, shifted far to the right. And you saw this in small cities and rural areas across the North, really, this strong trend toward Trump. And I would think that would, you know, I think that is continuing. And there's also a danger for Democrats that for as bad as Clinton did outside of big cities and suburban areas in 2016, that it may very well be possible for the next Democrat to do even worse. And that even if that person is also running up bigger margins in the suburbs and the big cities, that math doesn't necessarily work in their favor in a lot of these states that we're talking about as being electorally important.
Okay. So you've actually gotten to exactly the point I wanted to get to, because the situation in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin are very much the same. And we have been right. focusing on these suburban voters and how they have been trending. But really, the big story of 2016, at least in Wisconsin, and I'm guessing in Pennsylvania as well, was the overwhelming margins that Trump ran up in the rural areas. And there's very little indication that that support is eroding. So while we're all focused on the urban vote and the suburban vote, the real story has been the Republican growth in the rural areas and the number of counties they have flipped from Obama to Trump in 2016. And that's certainly the story in Wisconsin.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think if you look even more recently in Wisconsin, if you look at that state Supreme Court race from earlier this year, I really thought that the Democrats, in terms of just like what the overall map looked like, that to me sort of at a higher level or at sort of a broad level looked like a winning map for the Democrats. And yet the turnout was very good in Northwest Wisconsin, Wisconsin's 7th congressional district, where we're going to have a special election early next year after Sean Duffy is leaving the House. That's a place that has become very Republican and it was turning out in good numbers. And I think that sort of helped explain how the Republican backed candidate was able to win that race. And, you know, I think we saw it in the governor's race, which was very close to the Democrats won. But, you know, that may be something of a model to look at, in that the Democrats are getting these ever increasing blowout margins in Milwaukee, and particularly in Dane County, where Madison is, where also we're seeing a lot of growth, people coming in to not just work, you know, for government or the university, but also for some new industries that have popped up in Madison. But the Republicans are helping or combating that by turning a lot of the northern half of the state from sort of purple to red, or from red to dark red.
You know, I have been one of those who's peddled the narrative that Wisconsin was lost because African-American Democrats in Milwaukee didn't turn out. And it made sense to me because Hillary got about 40,000 fewer votes than Barack Obama got out of Milwaukee County. So considering that you know, Trump won the state by 23,000 votes, you think, well, it's just simply because Milwaukee didn't turn out. But I saw an analysis recently that pointed out that the net loss, Hillary's net loss in the rest of Wisconsin, which, you know, read rural Wisconsin, was minus 250,000 votes. I mean, that is really the story. So you're right. I mean, you have these super majorities for the Democrats in Milwaukee, super majorities in Dane County in the Madison area, and they've been turning out in massive numbers. But if they continue to lose, erode in the rest of the state, it becomes difficult. Now, of course, the other puzzle in Wisconsin, you know, has been, well, before I get to that, the suburbs around Milwaukee, the so-called WOW suburbs, Washington County, Ozaukee County, Waukesha County, had always been the, you know, the beating heart of the Republican Party, the, you know, overwhelmingly Republican, you know, stronghold. And it still is. But Trump had historically underperformed there, which was why you look at the map and you think there's just no way if he loses, down 10, loses 10 percentage points in the WOW counties or 5%, whatever it was, there's no way that he's going to be able to win the state, not accounting for rural Wisconsin. But I want to talk about that right after a word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by Blinkist. Let me tell you about one of the ultimate life hacks. It's hard to find the time to sit down and read and learn more. You all know that. But when you don't have the free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's an incredible app that solves this problem, and I really highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique, and it works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people like business leaders are well known for reading lots of books. Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so that you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, on your lunch break, or while you exercise, or, well, like me, walking the dog. 8 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library. From self-help books, business, health, to history books, Blinkist has the latest titles from best-selling lists, as well as the classic nonfiction titles that you always meant to read but never had time to. So I like Blinkist especially because it gives me the main points of a book, and which helps me to evaluate which books I want to make time to read in full later. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, and all for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for you. Go to Blinkist.com/bulwark. Try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/bulwark to start your free 7-day trial. And you'll also save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/bulwark. But the puzzle in Wisconsin, and which I will admit that a lot of people didn't see coming, was the split vote phenomenon in 2018. We thought that had simply disappeared because everybody was in lockstep. But you had the governor's race, which was very, very close. Scott Walker lost by like about 23,000 votes, too. It's around 20,000. But very liberal Democratic incumbent Senator Tammy Baldwin won in a blowout. She won by more than 10 points. So and she ran as a very, very – she ran against a very Trumpy Republican. So I guess the question is, what reflected the electorate in Wisconsin, the mood of the electorate, the governor's race, which was basically a coin flip, or the Senate race, which was a Democratic blowout?
I do think that incumbency does still matter to some extent. And of course, you had a Republican incumbent running for governor, a Democratic incumbent running for senator. We saw this sort of similar dynamic in Ohio, in which Sherrod Brown won by about 7 points, but then Mike DeWine won the governor's race by about 3.5 points, which is basically a very similar. Now, Ohio's more Republican than Wisconsin is, but you saw this basically 10% of the electorate or so was splitting their tickets for Republican for governor and a Democrat for senator, incumbent Democratic senator and a liberals both in terms of Baldwin and also Sherrod Brown in Ohio. And it also might reflect that some voters do treat state politics maybe a little bit different than federal politics. But, if the federal mood is more reflective of Baldwin's margin, that means that Trump's in a lot of trouble in Wisconsin. But I'm not necessarily sure that's that's very clearly the case at this point.
Okay, so the last swing state we have here is Arizona. Interesting, Cindy McCain gave an interview this week where she said that she didn't feel that the Republican Party represented people like her anymore, and she could see Arizona going Republican. I'm sorry, going Democrat, which would have been unthinkable just a few years ago.
So I mentioned a little bit ago that Tarrant County, which is Fort Worth in Texas, is one of the few big counties that still one of the top 50 population counties that still votes Republican for president. One of the others is Maricopa County, which is Phoenix, which voted relatively narrowly for Trump. Maricopa makes up about 60% of the entire statewide vote in Arizona. And so that you could kind of look at Arizona as almost a city state, in that Phoenix is such a dominant, in Maricopa County is such a dominant part of the population center in the state. And so in some ways it's kind of like Nevada with Las Vegas kind of in Metro Las Vegas kind of dominating things. And the trend line, even in the few Republican leaning big counties, I think is pretty clear in that this population density has basically become predictive. A lot of these places are becoming more and more Democratic. We saw in 2016, Orange County in California voted Democratic for the first time since FDR in 1936. And, you could look at, Arizona and Orange County in California as being some of the places that were kind of the bedrock foundations of the kind of modern Republican Party. You think about Barry Goldwater and a lot of other kind of conservative agitation in those places. And yet the trends in those places also, I think, have been Democratic. And we saw the Democrats, I think, made some inroads in Arizona in 2018. And I just think that if Maricopa truly trends to becoming a true swing county, or one that is a little bit Democratic leaning, I think it's pretty hard for Republicans to sort of make up ground in the rest of the state. And I've almost gotten to the point where I'm thinking that if the Democrats can't win Wisconsin, and I mean, I think that they can, but it's certainly possible Trump would carry it again, that, maybe you could see the Democrats make up for that in Arizona if in fact the Republicans are losing ground in that state. And I have to say, too, that the state party organization, which famously, I think, is feuded with John McCain when he was still alive, and McCain sometimes had primary trouble in that state. I think it's sort of reflective of a hardening ideology amongst Arizona Republicans just at the time where a more flexible approach, I think, would do them well. I mean, Doug Ducey got reelected as governor in Arizona, and I don't think that he is a fire-breathing conservative, and he certainly did a lot better than Martha McSally did in the Senate race. And yet I think that, again, that the state party organization and some of the key players out there may be kind of becoming more kind of Trumpish. And I just don't know if that's a great fit for that state. It might have been a great fit 20 years ago, but I don't know if it's a great fit now.
Yeah, you're being very, very diplomatic. I mean, they got a real crazy streak going on down there. And, from Sheriff Joe on down, that obviously is a factor here. So, Kristen, it's Kristen Sinema, right?
Yes, right.
I always get the Kirsten and the Christians.
Kirsten, actually. Sorry. Kirsten Sinema.
Kirsten Sinema?
Yes.
I want to get it right. Okay, whatever. So,
yeah.
Well, it was interesting that she won in that Senate race, but she won running as a very much a centrist Democrat.
Certainly
what we would regard as a centrist Democrat. And this is, of course, the question about 2020. Is the Democratic Party going to how far left are they going to move? So I'm looking at this map, and maybe this is beyond your crystal ball. I'm looking at this map, and in which you basically say the election will likely be decided in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Arizona. Well, those are the three toss-ups. I mean, there are some other states that could flip. Which state can an Elizabeth Warren win that a Joe Biden couldn't?
So that's a good question. And I think we're still kind of figuring out the strengths and weaknesses of these candidates. And I think what the Warren defenders, and I think maybe some of the Bernie Sanders defenders would say is that Warren and Sanders are sort of more liberal, but hey, that's actually a better way to turn out the electorate. And also, Biden has certain liabilities that maybe Trump would be able to, exploit. I mean, I think in some ways Trump was able to get to the left of Hillary Clinton on certain issues and was able to use certain comments that Clinton had said in the 90s about the whole super predators thing as a way to try to point out to African Americans that Clinton was not necessarily, or that Clinton was sort of too draconian on criminal justice stuff, and maybe that was an effective tool to try to depress the African American turnout. It's sort of, you know, it's hard to know specifically, but you could imagine Trump doing the same thing to Biden on that kind of issue. I could imagine, given that Biden was the long-standing senator from Delaware, a state where financial services are very important, could you imagine Trump getting to the left of Biden on, you know, on banking issues, on financial services things? I could imagine that, you know, and in some ways, Trump, I think Trump kind of changed the Republican Party message to make it more populist and really just to sound like a Democrat on certain things. Certainly on trade, he did, and other issues. And so from that standpoint, you could maybe argue that, well, Biden is potentially too compromised to run against Trump. It may not be obvious now, but maybe it would be obvious later in the campaign. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that. I'm just sort of playing devil's advocate.
It's an interesting argument, I mean, that it's easier for Trump to run as a populist against an establishment figure like Biden than it would be against a more populist Democrat.
Yeah, yes. You said in a few words what it took me many more words to try to say. But I guess, of course, the Biden argument is more obvious, in which he would say, hey, I'm not super far left on policy. I'm running as a candidate who can essentially be a caretaker that, you know, if you don't like Trump, you could vote for me. I'm not going to govern the country in a extremely ideological way. And again, that may be very, very, very much appealing, particularly to some of the voters who are most important, namely kind of lapsed Republicans in the suburbs who maybe voted third party last time, maybe grudgingly voted for Trump, but think that Trump's conduct in office has just been sort of beyond the pale, and they want to vote for a Democrat, but they don't want to vote for a Democrat who is running on massive structural change to the economy. And again, what the Warren Sanders folks would say is that actually promising structural change will generate the turnout that we as Democrats need. You know, again, I don't think there are necessarily easy answers to this, although I will say that there has been some compelling analysis that particularly by Nate Cohn of the New York Times, that even if Democrats did generate higher turnout across the country, that would not necessarily benefit them everywhere. Specifically in the electorally important Midwest, higher turnout might actually mean more white voters without college degrees coming out, and those are voters who Democrats struggle with. Now, in the Sun Belt, higher turnout might mean a more diverse electorate, which generically helps Democrats. And that might be helpful in states like Arizona, Texas, Florida, North Carolina, et cetera. And it's also convenient, I think, for people who are strong partisans and strongly ideological, and both on the right and the left. I think you might have heard this sort of similar kind of argument from someone like Ted Cruz in 2016, that, hey, we can go hard right and also generate more turnout, or, you know, and it's convenient because it essentially says, hey, we don't have to, not only do we not have to change anything about our program, we actually can become more extreme. It would actually help us electorally. So you can basically have your cake and eat it too. And that's effectively the Sanders argument, and I think Warren to some degree as well. And I think it's just a little too convenient to actually be correct. I think that there's more of a persuasion aspect here than maybe we sort of give it credit for.
Well, and of course, that was part of the argument was made down in Florida and Georgia, that you didn't need to go for the persuadable voters. You just ginned your base up, turned your base out in as big a numbers as possible. And of course, that fell short. They did not win there. Okay, so we're talking about a lot of unknowns about 2020, including how impeachment will play out. Up until 5 minutes ago, Nancy Pelosi was sort of the paragon of the conventional wisdom that an impeachment by the House might actually backfire, that it might inspire more Republican turnout, that it would force the Republicans into a sort of a harder shell around Donald Trump, that it might in fact alienate swing voters. But now, I mean, this train is going. I mean, this is going to happen sometime either late this year, more likely early next year. The House of Representatives is actually going to vote to impeach Donald Trump. Any sense about how this impacts this map?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's natural to think back to the last time this happened in 1998 when the Republicans pursued impeachment of Bill Clinton. Of course, they did vote to impeach him. There was a trial in the Senate. The president was acquitted fairly comfortably. And a lot of people feel like that benefited Democrats in that midterm election, which I think is true to at least some extent, maybe not to as much as popularly remembered. But I don't think it necessarily helped the Republicans in a narrow electoral standpoint in 1998. I think one of the big differences is just fundamentally it's a different election. You know, the impeachment would be happening in the lead up to a presidential election. And you have to ask yourself, are there people who would be voting against Trump who would vote for him because the Democrats unsuccessfully tried to impeach him? And maybe that's true because, you know, I think a big part of the Republican argument in trying to support the president's reelection is essentially to say that this election is not a referendum on Trump. It is a choice and the Democrats are off the reservation. And maybe impeachment would help them make that case. But I've got to say, you know, the speaker may have changed her mind here because basically this Ukraine whistleblower complaint and the specifics of what we have heard about it basically just stinks so bad that they had no other choice, which may actually be a compelling argument. It may be that this is an easier thing to explain to the public than maybe the Mueller report specifics were, that the president, you know, is acting in his capacity as president. Arguably, well, I think pretty clearly from what we've seen, as you know, using interactions with foreign governments for personal gain. I mean, again, it seems to be right there now. Whether the Democrats can sort of make the sale on it, whether the electorate actually wants to hear about it or not, I don't know. But impeachment may be a useful tool in basically acting as a way to essentially promote the findings here, which again I think are pretty explosive, and we've seen some, even some Republicans sort of acknowledge that, even while the bulk of the party is rallying around the president.
And you don't need to move a lot of voters. I mean, I doubt that any of the Trump base is going to be moved, or the Democratic base is going to be moved. But if you're talking about a president who is at 43-44% of the vote, let's say approval rating, if Trump is at 44-43% of approval rating, he can be reelected. That can happen. You could certainly run this scenario. You drop him down to 38%, and it becomes a very, very different picture. So the difference between even 42 and 40, or again, just, you know, 3, 4, 5 points, particularly among independents or swing voters, and it could make the difference between a Trump reelection, a very, very close election, or a potential blowout election.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And so to the extent that you can sort of move some voters on the fence, that is very valuable to the Democrats. You also have to remember this. I think that there's been this almost overcorrection since 2016 that basically every single person who voted for Donald Trump is in love with him and is unmovable. And I just really don't think that's true. I mean, even if you go back and look at the exit poll from 2016, a fifth of the electorate roughly said that they had unfavorable views of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And Trump won that group 47-30. The remaining portion of that vote made up essentially almost all of the third party votes, which, of course, would make sense that the third party votes would be, would naturally not favor either of the major party candidates. And so there were a lot of people who were on the fence and maybe didn't like their choices and decided to vote for Trump for one reason or the other. And Trump has probably converted some of those folks. But I would imagine there's still a lot of them who feel uneasy about the choice that they made. And again, if the Democrats can kind of make the case that the unease that some of those voters felt about Trump is still present, then some of those folks may switch sides. And again, it's not going to take that many people. We're only talking about really 1-2% of the electorate in a handful of these key states that can turn a Republican victory in the Electoral College to a Democratic one.
Kyle, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it very much. Kyle Kondik is the managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball, and the piece is the Electoral College Expanding the Map, which you can find online. Appreciate it very, very much, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.